We gather here for sacred time, and it is a sacred time, this. It is a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In honor of our service and of our lives, let us take some moments to honor the quiet parts of our lives. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. The attitude of prayer. For this Veterans Day, let us remember the sacred covenant we have with our soldiers. As they promise to risk everything, to risk even their lives, we must promise that the cause for which we send them forth is worth the sacrifice of their lives. We are humbled by the sacrifice our soldiers offer us, but our covenant cuts both ways, and we must meet their courage with our own. Let us fight for those who fight for us. Surely there are causes worth the ultimate sacrifice. Just as surely, they are few and far between. We must be able to say that the motives behind their war are worth the cost of their lives and the lives of the thousands or tens of thousands of those we tell them to kill. And if we do not believe that, then let us have the courage to speak, to act, to make it right before our soldiers have sacrificed so much that it can never be made right again. Times that call for soldiers are times that call as well for our courage. Let us never forget our part in the sacred covenant with our soldiers. Let us have the courage and the will to fight for those who fight for us. That much courage, that much will. Nothing less will do. Amen. I would like to ask the veterans here to stand, please. Thank you. Veterans Day is always the hardest of the year for me to translate into a sermon, because it encompasses so much more than words and thoughts. It encompasses the experience of my war, even the sights and the smells and the sounds all these years later. It isn't an intellectual topic. All of this is partly why it's so clear to me that we have a sacred covenant with our soldiers and that we understand the nature of that covenant. Soldiers do their part by being willing to serve, perhaps to die. Our part is to assure them that the reasons for going to war are worth the sacrifice of their lives. And if we cannot say that, we have no moral right to send them to war. As a veteran of the Vietnam War, I know that soldiers carry more than just their combat gear into combat. They also carry the political baggage of their war and the ideology of their times. If you're lucky enough to be in a good war and World War II seems to be the only one of those that we've had, then soldiers carry the respect of their country and the approval of history. But if your turn comes up in a bad war, or a war fought for selfish or stupid reasons, then you carry that on your back too. Sometimes that unseen load seems to get heavier every day until it is overwhelming, as many of the veterans of the last few years of the Vietnam War can testify. And so 36 years after my war, I can't look at today's soldiers without wondering what they're carrying on their backs as they go into their war. And you don't have to be psychic to know that our soldiers in Iraq have a load on their backs. We're already starting to see headlines like those that came mostly at the end of the Vietnam War. It seems very early for those headlines. I've clipped just a few of the headlines from stories I've seen this week. Here are just a few of the headlines that have occurred in the last 7 days. A fiction shattered by America's aggression. Assassinations surge in Iraq. Rebel war spirals out of control as U.S. intelligence loses the plot. As casualties mount, doubts grow. 18 Americans dead, 21 wounded, a deadly day in Iraq. How many body bags? When will Bush address mounting casualties? Judge is shot dead as Iraqis' hatred of occupiers grows. Rage erupts over Iraq war profiteering, a high price for a hollow victory, and White House ignored Iraqi bid to avert war. And yesterday, while I was attending a district meeting in San Antonio, military families from across the state held a press conference in San Antonio demanding an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the immediate return of all troops to their home duty stations. These families represented soldiers from all four of the military bases in Texas. And again, I think it's very early in the war for this level of outrage and accusation to be surfacing. You wonder how we got in this mess, and I keep coming back to the old story that you've all heard about how to cook a frog. The story says that if you toss a frog in hot water, the frog will use every bit of its energy to jump out and escape. But if you put the frog in a pan of cooled water and raise the temperature very slowly, the frog gets used to it, doesn't notice the heat rise until it's too late and it's cooked. I've never tried that with a real frog. I just trust the story. If you've tried it with a real frog, I don't want to know about it. Now, anytime you talk like this, because of an atmosphere that I think has been intentionally created in our society, you can hear or imagine hearing some conservative or neoconservative voices crying, "There go those liberals again," always criticizing, never trusting their leaders. They're not good Americans. Good Americans follow their leader and support the troops in the war. Here is a quote I just read this week that seems to endorse this view, though it's a quote from a fairly surprising source. The job of the president is to set the agenda, and the job of the press is to follow the agenda that the leadership sets. That's from Lawrence Grossman, longtime head of PBS and NBC News. When the head of NBC News believes the job of the press is to follow the leader rather than informing those who are being led, it's easy to feel that those darned liberals are just out of touch. But then I remember another quotation, which you, I'm sure, have heard at least part of. It's much older. It came from a speech delivered in 1790. The condition upon which God has given liberty to man is eternal vigilance, which condition, if he break, servitude is at once the consequence of his crime and the punishment of his guilt. These two quotations seem to frame the options that were being offered today. Conservatives preaching obedience, liberals preaching vigilance and critical inquiries into the motives of those who are now leading our country. The options are framed as though they were merely partisan positions, as though nothing is really true, but thinking makes it so. Where Republicans are supposed to embrace obedience and Democrats try to awaken a country falling asleep in hot water. But it's not that simple now, and it has never been that simple. The families who protested in San Antonio yesterday came from both political parties, from conservative and liberal religions or no religions. They are among the voices saying that this is not about partisan politics. This is about the fate of America and the responsibility of all who feel the call of patriotism for this great country. I am one of those who believe we are being dangerously and unwisely misled, but I won't accept that as a partisan political statement anymore. To me, it's a patriotic statement, the kind that must be made by all who realize that liberty is always given to us on the condition of eternal vigilance, and that failing to be vigilant is failing to be patriotic, and that we do, in fact, have a sacred covenant with our soldiers. I want to borrow some comments from the so-called liberal media, which gets harder and harder to find, and mix them with my own to try and show you why some people do fear that we are violating our sacred covenant with our soldiers and with ourselves as Americans. First, I want to provide some historical background by sharing part of an essay written by Thomas Hartmann, published on March 23rd of this year. The title of the essay was "The Warnings of History." These are the kind of historical parallels that some feel are unwarranted and rude. I feel they are patriotic, honest, and timely, part of the eternal vigilance that we owe ourselves and our great country. Reflecting on economic crises, terrorists, and wars, Thomas Hartmann says, "It started when the government, in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings. The media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services knew, however, that the odds were he would eventually succeed. But the warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. Some said he was a simpleton, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language, reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalistic rhetoric offended the aristocrats, the foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. And as a young man, he had joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and bizarre initiation rituals that involved skulls and human bones. When an aide brought him the word that the nation's most prestigious building was ablaze, he called a press conference. He used the occasion, a sign from God, he called it, to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors, a people, he said, who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Priests could now intercept mail and wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if they thought the case might involve terrorism. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, the leader brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. Instead of referring to the nation by its name, he began to refer to it as the homeland. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that the leader was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, "Gott mit uns," God is with us. Soon he proposed a single new national agency to protect the security of the homeland. To consolidate his power, he reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the terrorists and to prepare for wars overseas. He built powerful alliances with industry. He then began a campaign to convince people of his nation that a small, limited war was necessary. He claimed the right to strike preemptively in self-defense, and nations across Europe at first denounced him for it, pointing out that it was a doctrine only claimed in the past by nations seeking worldwide empire, like Caesar's Rome or Alexander's Greece. The story, of course, is about Hitler and the rise of Nazi power. It looks to this writer, and to me, and to many others, like we are resolutely following the course that Hitler's Third Reich followed in our ambition to establish an American empire. The German word for empire is Reich. None of this is new information. The seeds of all this were planted in essays going back to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, when some neoconservatives argued that it was time for America to claim immediate military and economic domination of the world. Charles Krauthammer wrote this in an essay in 1989. The Fourth Reich, if you like. In 1992, another of those neoconservatives, Paul Wolfowitz, who was then Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, working for the Secretary of Defense in 1992, Dick Cheney. Wolfowitz supervised the drafting of the Defense Policy Guidance document, in which he outlined plans for military intervention in Iraq as an action necessary to assure, quote, access to vital raw material, primarily Persian Gulf oil, close quote, and to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and threats from terrorism. Wolfowitz in 1992 called for preemptive attacks and ad hoc coalitions, but said that the U.S. should be ready to act alone when collective action cannot be orchestrated. The primary goal of U.S. policy, he said, should be to prevent the rise of any nation that could challenge the United States. When the document was leaked to the New York Times 11 years ago, it proved so extreme and embarrassing that it was withdrawn. The first President Bush refused to endorse it. These concepts are now part of the new U.S. national security strategy. That strategy, which came out, I believe, in October of 2000, or late September of 2000, followed the ideas in an earlier paper from September of 2000 on rebuilding America's defenses, part of the project for the new American century, published by a group of 27 neoconservatives, including Wolfowitz and Cheney. Six of the key authors of that report now hold high positions in the Bush administration. Donald Kagan, a co-editor of that report, is a prominent and important government advisor from his position as a classics professor at Yale. And the 2000 report directly acknowledged its debt to the 1992 document written by Wolfowitz. If you believe these plans for an American empire of military dominion of the world are the primary mission of the Bush administration, as many people do, then everything going on now makes a new kind of sense where all the pieces fit together. It means that the war in Iraq marks the official emergence of the United States as a full-fledged global empire. Once that's understood, other mysteries solve themselves. For example, why does the administration seem unconcerned about an exit strategy from Iraq? Because we won't be leaving. We still have bases in Germany and Japan 58 years after the end of World War II. We'll be staying in Iraq and the Middle East. Having conquered Iraq, the United States will create permanent bases from which to dominate the Middle East, including neighboring Iran. And why did the administration dismiss the option of containing and deterring Iraq, as we had the Soviet Union for 45 years? Because even if it worked, containment and deterrence would not allow the expansion of American power. The plan dismisses deterrence as a Cold War relic and instead talks of, quote, convincing or compelling states to accept their sovereign responsibilities. Donald Kagan, the professor of classical Greek history at Yale and an influential advocate of a more aggressive foreign policy, describes the new world order in cowboy terms. You saw the movie High Noon, he asks. We're Gary Cooper. Kagan also acknowledges that we will most likely establish permanent military bases in Iraq. He says, quote, we'll probably need a major concentration of forces in the Middle East over a long period of time. When we have economic problems, it's been caused by disruptions in our oil supply. If we have a force in Iraq, there will be no disruption in oil supplies. Paul Wolfowitz said in an interview several months ago that the reason we cared about Iraq but not North Korea was because Iraq was, quote, swimming in oil. But even in his 1992 paper, he had identified Iraqi oil as a major reason for ousting Saddam Hussein and taking effective control of the country. Don't tell me it's mudslinging to say that the war is about oil. That's what those who've planned it have claimed for more than 11 years. To see who the new American empire would serve, you only have to look at the changes in the economy and tax laws since Bush was elected. It is to be an empire rewarding the corporations and the very wealthy, and as far as possible, eliminating the middle class to create a kind of two-tiered economy that has worked so well to reward so few and impoverish so many in Mexico. But putting Americans out of work to be replaced by cheaper foreign labor is not only happening at Walmart. It's happening in the high-tech industries, too, as many of you know firsthand. Corporations such as Cigna, General Electric, and Merrill Lynch are already using a loophole called the L-1 visa to import low-wage technology workers from India to replace their American employees, paying them a third to a half less than the American employees, and have already brought some 325,000 computer engineers, programmers, and other high-tech employees from abroad, mostly from India. This is a full-scale drive toward the military domination of the world and the subjugation of anyone who could protest. That's why civil rights are being curtailed as part of the security for the homeland, and why it is likely that repressive forms of religion will gain both power and influence. Here's one more quotation from another very important neoconservative named Richard Perle. In case you think I'm overstating things. Perle says, "This is total war. We're fighting a variety of enemies. There are lots of them out there. All this talk about first we're going to do Afghanistan, then we'll do Iraq, then we'll take a look around and see how things stand. This is entirely the wrong way to go about it. If we just let our vision of the world go forth and we embrace it entirely, and we don't try to piece together clever diplomacy, but just wage a total war, our children will sing great songs about us years from now." Don't tell me this is partisan talk. This is patriotic talk that all Americans need to become aware of to confront and expose these things. Don't tell me it's partisan talk. It's not. These are the battles our soldiers are being used to fight. They are battles for a concept of empire so similar to the vision of Hitler's Nazi party of 60 years ago that it is hard to consider all the similarities accidental. This is the ideology our soldiers are carrying into battle with them as they fight, kill, and die, not for freedom or the American way, but for greed, arrogance, and a murderous lust for power that seems terrifyingly insane. As the water heats up, it's worth considering again some lessons of history from the 1930s and 1940s. Both America and Germany were deep into economic depression. This is how Thomas Hartmann described it. Germany's response was to use government to empower corporations and reward the society's richest individuals, to privatize much of the commons, stifle dissent, strip people of constitutional rights, and create an illusion of prosperity through continual and ever-expanding war. America, instead, passed minimum wage laws to raise up the middle class, enforced antitrust laws to diminish the power of corporations, increased taxes on corporations and the wealthiest individuals, created Social Security, and became the employer of last resort through programs to build national infrastructure, promote the arts, and replant forests. America's leaders and America's soldiers 60 years ago fought for democracy, which means a powerful middle class and rigorous controls on the natural human greed exhibited in all times and places by wealthy corporations and individuals. We're still proud of those soldiers. Germany's leaders and soldiers fought for an economic and military tyranny that is the mortal enemy of democracy any time and any place. They looted the working class and transferred money, power, and privilege to their wealthiest individuals and corporations while restricting the rights of ordinary people to protest. No one today is very proud of them. It is time to think about Veterans Day. And so it is time again to assess the nature and the quality of our sacred covenant with our soldiers. Can we honestly tell them that these mad dreams of a few leaders are worth their sacrifices and their lives, let alone the lives of more than 15,000 Iraqis estimated killed so far? Our soldiers carry into battle not only their weapons and supplies, but also the weight of the cause for which we are asking them to fight, to kill, and to die. Can we honestly look them in the face and tell them that we have honored our part of our sacred covenant with them? If our motives are indeed the motives of dominating the world, the motives of empire, then these deaths on both sides are not casualties of war, but murders. And the actions of our current administration are, by the definitions we used at Nuremberg, war crimes. This isn't a question for our leaders anymore. It's a question for those who understand that the price of liberty is always eternal vigilance. It is a question for us.